Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present William Grider of The Nation magazine, who predicts the death of FDR's New Deal programs unless a re-energized progressive social movement emerges to resist the bipartisan assault on the poor and middle class. Chip Berlay, senior analyst with Political Research Associates, who explains why he believes the Tucson massacre is not an anomaly among politically motivated violence in America. And Vernon Haltom of Coal River Mountain Watch, who examines the mixed messages behind the Environmental Protection Agency's recent reversal on issuing a mountaintop removal coal mining permit in West Virginia. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In early January, suspected anti-Castro terrorist Luis Posada Carriles, implicated in the 1976 bombing of a Cuban airliner that killed over 70 people, went on trial in El Paso, Texas. Instead of being charged with terrorism or murder, Posada is facing allegations of fraud, including making false statements to authorities and using a phony passport. After being released from prison in Panama in 2004 for his attempt to assassinate Fidel Castro with 200 pounds of dynamite, Posada arrived in Miami and sought U.S. citizenship. After an international outcry, agents from the Department of Homeland Security questioned the Cuban exile in May 2005. He was later detained for illegally entering the United States. According to The Nation magazine, the U.S. Justice Department called a grand jury in New Jersey to investigate Posada's role in the bombing of a Havana hotel that killed an Italian businessman, but no indictments were made. In January 2007, Posada was indicted in El Paso, Texas, on 6 counts of making false statements. Later that same year, federal judge Kathleen Cordone dismissed the indictments, saying the government had violated Posada's legal rights. In 2008, the Fifth District Court of Appeals reinstated the charges against Posada, and the case went to trial. In a pretrial hearing, Judge Cardone allowed Posada's lengthy ties with the CIA, which dates back to the 1961 Bay of Pigs invasion of Cuba, to be used as evidence in the trial. In Havana, Cuban government officials have worked with teams of FBI agents and U.S. prosecutors and turned over 1,500 pages of evidence in the hotel bombing case. They also helped U.S. prosecutors contact some of Posada's accomplices who are still living in Cuba. Climate scientists in South Asia are making a new push to accurately document the loss of glacial ice in the eastern Himalayas, the water source for 1.3 billion people in South and Southeast Asia. Glaciers in the eastern Himalayas feed Asia's major river systems, including the Ganges in India, the Indus River in Pakistan, and the Mekong River, which runs from western China through Southeast Asia and spills into the South China Sea. In Nepal, the Imja Glacier is melting by 70 meters a year, reports the Interpress service. In Bhutan, bordering India and China, 25 glaciers have lost an alarming volume of glacial ice, shrinking by 20 to 30 meters a year. In recent years, there has been controversy over the quality of climate research on glaciers in the Himalayas, prompting a new effort to develop reliable climate models in the region. Some climate scientists fear that recent disputes involving China's dam building along the upper Mekong River will overshadow the need for better climate research and data collection. Across the United States, Republicans who took control over state legislatures and governorships in the November election are pushing hard to enact tougher voter ID requirements. According to the American Prospect magazine, the legislative push on voter ID bills has already begun in North Carolina, Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Kansas. Voting rights activists say that new voter ID laws discriminate against senior citizens, African Americans, and low-income voters. They also maintain that ID laws waste taxpayers' money at a time when many states face budget deficits. Critics like the progressive think tank Demos point to research showing there are few cases of people impersonating another registered voter at the polls. According to a study by Barnard College, there were only 24 convictions for illegal voting across the United States between 2002 and 2005. And most of those cases involve people who are not eligible to vote, a situation that could not be detected by voter ID laws. The 2008 U.S. Supreme Court case Crawford v. Marion County, which upheld Indiana's restrictive voter ID law, also required states to provide IDs to people who do not have one, money that could otherwise be spent on improving training for election workers and educating citizens about the voting process. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
As the new year began, a power shift to the right, resulting from the November congressional election, got underway in Washington, D.C. John Boehner became Speaker of the House of Representatives as Republicans became the majority party there, while the GOP gained 6 seats in the Senate but remained in the minority. But even as Democrats continue to control the White House and Senate, a not-so-subtle shift is taking place with regard to the party's defense of the social safety net built by President Franklin Delano Roosevelt during the Great Depression. An erosion of the Democrats' principled opposition to the Republican and corporate agenda, favoring tax cuts for the wealthy, a reduction in government programs, and deregulation of business is apparent for all to see. The signs include President Obama's surrender to the GOP on retaining Bush-era tax cuts for the wealthiest Americans in last year's lame duck session, the recommendations by Mr. Obama's hand-picked co-chairs of his debt commission to raise the Social Security retirement age and make major cuts to Social Security and Medicare benefits, and his appointment of J.P. Morgan Chase Vice Chairman William Daley as his new Chief of Staff. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with William Grider, National Affairs correspondent with The Nation magazine, who discusses why he believes the death of FDR's New Deal programs are imminent unless re-energized progressive social movements emerge to resist the bipartisan assault on the poor and middle class.
Obama, I think, with utter sincerity, would like to sort of work things out across the ideological and party divides. And I don't doubt that he is sincere about that, but it's so out of step with the enormity of what we are facing that you begin to question the sincerity. I think the Democrats, having for many years sustained the idea that we still believe in those things, in social justice, in equity, in protecting the weak and the innocent from the depredations of big business or big banks or whoever, they could say that with great clarity when they were out of power. And they did. And so many of us could say, well, it's not fair to judge them because they're now out of lack the ability to do anything about these aggravations and afflictions. And so withhold judgment. And now, in the last 2 years, judgment has arrived, at least for me and I think others, where we saw them repeatedly decline to assert the powers of government to correct these things. And indeed, even to try to work out deals with the sectors of the economy that were responsible. The most visible but dramatic one is banking and finance, who everybody understands caused this calamity and the collapse and huge losses and great dislocations. The government, starting with George W. Bush, but then continuing under Obama, basically makes them well. And that's first on the agenda. Let's get the banks out of their problems. And that may indeed have been an imperative, but they didn't ask for anything in return or demand anything in return. That's the center of my disappointment, and I think our complaints will be tested in the next few years.
We've seen President Obama from the White House negotiate an extension of the tax cuts for the wealthiest sectors of society, and at the same time he handpicked a deficit commission that mostly agree, whatever party they belong to, they mostly agree on cutbacks in Social Security, raising the eligibility age, and reductions in Medicare benefits. What is the signal in terms of what's going to happen in the next year or so when this new Republican Congress is going to drive as hard as they can to undercut Social Security and these other social programs in confluence with what seems to be a similar agenda from the White House?
Well, that's part of my judgment. My harsh judgment about the Democratic Party. The Republican position has been well known for 80 years, and they're unrelenting. They hate Social Security. They hated it when it was created, and they've hated it actively ever since. The shock is the Democratic position. We have a Democratic president now who is saying, well, let's sit down and talk about this. We can work something out. And that puts a lot of us right on at battle stations, because Republicans might actually succeed in disabling Social Security and ultimately destroying it if the Democrats cooperate with that. And there's a lot of nervousness in Washington right now among people like myself and others who are active in the political system that the president at his State of the Union may announce some grand prospect for compromise on Social Security and Medicare. I hope that gossip is wrong, but I know people have been to the White House to express their alarm, and were not entirely reassured by the answer they got from the president's staff. So we'll see. I think it's disastrous if he gives in to that crusade. And that's part of why I say it's the end of the New Deal, if that's what is about to unfold.
William Grider, as you look around the country now, you've got angry Tea Party folks on the right. You've got a left that's quite disorganized and dispirited, I would say myself. Do you see any hope that people will say enough at some point with compromises to the right and the corporate agenda, and that people will rise up, labor unions, working folks, and say, we've had it. We're not going to take this land down, and that Social Security is going to be the big demarcating fight that really could be a turning point for the country's politics?
Yeah, I think that is possible. I won't say more than that, and I obviously, you've read my piece, that my hope hangs on that thread, that will indeed happen, and I think there's a good basis for believing in the possibility, and, you know, one of my small roles is to sort of stand on the creased corner urging people to throw off the cynicism and the resignation and all the rest, and throw off especially the propaganda of mass media, and take responsibility for the country, for themselves, for their futures. And I literally think we're now at a profound turning point in the history of America. And we've discussed a couple of aspects of it, but there are many more. It's the war. We're fighting wars all over the world while we're borrowing the money to do so. The ecological damage has now reached a stage where people can see concretely the destruction that lies ahead if they don't change things. The searing inequality in our society, which has developed over the last 30 years, thanks to that right-wing doctrine of everybody for themselves, never mind the society. I can go on. You know the list, probably. But in that situation, I think in my last book I argued the only thing that can pull us out of what we're in now is a popular mobilization.
That was William Grider, National Affairs Correspondent with The Nation magazine. Grider's widely acclaimed books include Who Will Tell the People? And Secrets of the Temple. Read his recent article, The End of New Deal Liberalism, online at thenation.com. The national debate which followed accused gunman Jared Lee Loeffner's January 8th Tucson shooting rampage that killed 6 and wounded 13, including U.S. Representative Gabrielle Giffords, followed a familiar script. Conservative commentators and politicians, who regularly accuse their opponents of being traitors, communists, allies of terrorists, and enemies of America, strongly rejected any connection between their angry, hateful rhetoric with politically motivated violence in Tucson or anywhere else. Right-wing talk show hosts like Glenn Beck, Bill O'Reilly, and Rush Limbaugh, as well as conservative politicians like Sarah Palin, dismissed the criticism, while narrowly asserting that the accused would-be assassin was mentally ill and his horrendous act of violence had nothing to do with their harsh rhetoric or their frequent use of violent language and gun metaphors. But try as they might to disregard politically motivated violence by right-wing movements in America, there is a record which cannot be ignored. Over the past 2 years, 19 people have been killed and 26 wounded by persons motivated by racist or anti-government ideology, including a security guard at the Holocaust Museum in Washington, 3 police officers in Pittsburgh, abortion doctor George Tiller in Wichita, and 2 IRS workers at a government office in Austin. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Chip Burleigh, senior analyst with Political Research Associates and author of the report titled Toxic to Democracy, Conspiracy Theories, Demonization, and Scapegoating. Here, Burleigh explains why the Tucson massacre is not an anomaly among politically motivated violence in America.
You know, when you have a whole network of right-wing demagogues, and you have political pundits, and you have Republican Party officials who tolerate describing the president and his program as not just wrong-headed and a bad idea, but portraying Obama and liberals and leftists as traitors. You know, we're out to destroy America. We have some secret scheme. You know, that creates a milieu where I think violence is more likely. Now, can we say that because Sarah Palin had crosshairs on, you know, Representative Gabrielle Giffords' district, that that's what motivated Lochner? No, and people who say that are making outlandish statements. But to suggest that 30 years of right-wing demagoguery about liberals selling out America doesn't have an effect. I mean, of course it has an effect. It has an effect that is well studied in social science. And just because someone is unhinged doesn't mean they pick their targets randomly. They usually pick their targets based on being embedded in some kind of political climate or cultural climate in which they think their act is heroic or necessary.
There have been strong objections to the direction and focus of this discussion on the rhetoric, on the hateful rhetoric by many conservative commentators and politicians. They dismiss in general the criticism as misplaced. Many of these conservative folks assert the accused would-be assassin Jared Lee Lochner is mentally ill, and his act of horrendous violence has nothing whatsoever to do with politics and nothing to do with violent-laden rhetoric or Sarah Palin's use of gun sights on her target list of Democrats. But there is violence out there, violent incidents motivated by politics, pure and simple. But I don't think a lot of those incidents and attacks that have happened over the last 10 or 15 years have been much mentioned in this debate in the corporate media. Maybe you could run down for us some of what we should know about the violence that is occurring there that is certainly politically motivated.
Well, you go back to the mid-1990s as an example of a period when President Clinton was being attacked as having assassinated his political advisor and engaging in all kinds of illegal activities. And the Vince Foster incident was touted all over the right-wing media as evidence that Clinton was a murderer of his own advisor. So, I mean, what comes out of that milieu and the years of kind of vitriol against Clinton and the Democrats? We end up having the Oklahoma City bombing where 168 people eventually died. Nichols is still alive in jail, but Timothy McVeigh was executed for that. And people say, well, there's no evidence that he was in a militia movement, which is technically true, but people don't join militia movements and get membership card. While Nichols was associated with many different militia activists through his sales of survivalist and weapons equipment at gun shows, that McVeigh had moved on into a neo-Nazi cell. And so, you know, to try and argue that McVeigh was not tied to right-wing politics in America is absurd. So we know that political violence is focused on political rhetoric and the cultural milieu. If you look recently, since Obama was elected, there have been 20 people now killed by folks who appear to have been caught up in some kind of rhetoric about the government being illegitimate or paving the way for moral depravity. Look at the killing of Dr. Tiller, the reproductive rights medical doctor who was shot after months of Bill O'Reilly basically calling him a murderer. There's no connection there, they would argue, and some do, but I think there's a connection in the milieu, in the incitement of anger and rage, and the targets sort of become obvious.
To what extent do you believe a lot of this hate speech and the culture wars that are being stoked by these political figures and the right-wing commentators, to what extent do you think this is camouflage for an entirely different agenda that stokes fear and hatred against immigrants, minorities, Jews, gays, and lesbians, while the rich push their agenda for less government regulation and less taxes and to destroy the New Deal social safety net that was put in place during the Great Depression?
Well, I think most of this tracks back to the attacks on Roosevelt, who was also called a communist, and there's a great book called Roosevelt's Red Record by Elizabeth Dilling. So what we have here is a coalition of moral traditionalists who don't like abortion and gay rights, of anti-communists who have morphed into anti-collectivists and social safety netters, the people who back laissez-faire capitalism and corporate wealth. But what the right-wing demagogues do is create scapegoats to distract us from having the conversation we need to have about building a firmer and sounder and fairer political economic system in the United States. And so, unlike most industrialized nations in the world, we're heading backwards back into that period when it was an oligarchy.
That was Chip Berlay, senior analyst with Political Research Associates. He's the author of a report titled Toxic to Democracy, Conspiracy Theories, Demonization, and Scapegoating. Contact PRA by calling area code 617-666-5300 or visit their website at publiceye.org. On January 13th, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency reversed a permit approved in 2007 by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers for the largest mountaintop removal operation in West Virginia, Arch Coal's Spruce No. 1 site, straddling Logan and Mingo counties in the coal-mining southern region of the state. The agency cited concerns about the potential impact on both the environment and human health. Mountaintop removal entails using tons of dynamite to literally blow off the tops of mountains to mine the coal seams underneath, and then dumping tons of waste into valleys below, sometimes covering up headwater streams. Groups opposed to mountaintop removal celebrated this decision, but have opposed some EPA actions that have granted permits for other mining sites. Mountaintop removal opponents are working for a complete ban on the process. Coal interests and West Virginia's congressional delegation, which now includes former Democratic Governor Joe Manchin, who won the late Senator Robert Byrd's seat, are calling for legislation that would rein in the EPA. And Acting Governor Earl Ray Tomblin, along with the coal industry, West Virginia legislators, and labor unions, organized a rally on January 20th to demonstrate support for coal mining in the state. Between the lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Vernon Haltom, co-director of Coal River Mountain Watch, about the mixed messages in the EPA's rationale for reversing its Arch coal permit approval.
There were concerns about the cumulative impact on the streams, the water quality, the vast number of miles, several miles of streams that would be buried, and human health impacts. And we were glad that they included that information. What the politicians aren't telling people while they're ranting and raving about the EPA is that there was a plan that probably would have met EPA's approval. It still would have buried over 3 miles of streams, but it would have cost the company about 55 cents more per ton of coal to do this other plan. So it's not the bright shining light from the sky that the EPA is suddenly going to start vetoing permits in mountaintop removal. It's just that, Arch Coal didn't want to spend 55 cents per ton to go with the other mining plan.
Some opponents of mountaintop removal have been more enthusiastic than you are about the EPA's decision on the Spruce No. 1 mining site, but you're saying it was a really close call and it's not precedent-setting?
Well, back in April, I believe it was April 1st of 2010, the EPA announced the strict guidelines that they were going to be using to scrutinize permits. And Lisa Jackson stated at that time that no or very few valley fills would be permitted. The first permit that they applied this guidance to, they did approve. It was the Hobet 45 permit, and it was over 3 miles of streams that they approved to be buried. Going from 3 miles of unburied streams to 3 miles of buried streams is not an improvement. But what happened in that case was that the EPA and the coal company arrived at an agreement based on re-engineered mining plans. and a similar re-engineered mining plan was put forth for the Spruce No. 1 mine. In this case, the coal company did not want to go that route and instead chose to basically throw the game, make it look like the EPA was completely unreasonable and cast them in a bad light, and give ammunition to the various politicians who are clamoring for the EPA to be gutted, essentially.
Vernon Haltom, I went on the Friends of Coal website and saw they're calling for Congress to rein in the EPA. Do you also expect coal interests to file a lawsuit against this EPA decision?
I think they're probably going to attack it in a couple of ways, possibly in the court and definitely the legislators. You know, legislators from West Virginia, what they amount to is coal industry lobbyists on U.S. taxpayers' payroll. They will do what they can to try and strip the EPA of whatever powers that they have. And in this case, you know, it would be stripping them of the power to enforce under the Clean Water Act. I mean, the Clean Water Act is a U.S. law that applies to all of the country. And what they're trying to do is to make it very difficult for the EPA to actually enforce, and it could have vast consequences everywhere.
So what's the next step for those of you opposed to mountaintop removal?
We've sent out the word and sent word to EPA that we support their decision in this case and that they should take stronger steps, deny all mountaintop removal permits, and abolish the practice. It kills people. We're not talking about salamanders and minnows or mayflies. We're talking about actual people who breathe the dust clouds, who drink the water, who get flooded out of their homes and killed in floods. All these things that kill people. Yet the industry wants to maintain that we don't exist. There's a lawsuit against the EPA based on their April 2010 guidelines that Governor Manchin filed, that the National Mining Association has filed, and I believe the state of Kentucky has filed against the EPA. And Coal River Mountain Watch has intervened in that lawsuit on behalf of the EPA. That's one thing we're doing, trying to, you know, stay in the legal loop there and intervene when we can. But this rally on Thursday, we are also showing up to have a counter rally. Acting Governor Tomlin told people to come and show the EPA the impacts of coal on the people of West Virginia. Well, what he meant was people who draw a paycheck from coal. I don't think he was counting on those of us who suffer negative impacts to show up.
That was Vernon Haltom of Coal River Mountain Watch. Contact the group by calling area code 304-854-2182 or visit their website at crmw.net. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-268-8446 or write to Between the Lines, care of Squeaky Wheel Productions, P.O. Box 110176, Trumbull, Connecticut, 06611. Visit our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.